waves to have real pointing vector, real energy that's being transmitted. Ain't that crazy? It's hidden in the way we were taught, but the real meaning of what we taught, we all missed it the first time around. I know you had some...
Repeater, time out, cancel.
I think it was Glenn now wants some further comments. KC2QIQ. Straighten us out on this good stuff, Glenn. K2LIW. What do you mean by permittivity?
The term, Dick, is permissivity. You have permeability, which is B over H, and permissivity is the point at which permeability intersects the E field at that point. So in other words, before you were referring to that as a coupling, but that's permissivity. So in other words, you have where your E field and your H field are intersecting at that point. That's a point of permissivity. And at that point, yes, the E field and the H field at that point are basically maximized and minimized in the same exact phase. Let me let it drop for a second. But actually, my comment is for something different. What we were talking about before was that that comment about the mass in space moving and then creating the electromagnetic field, and kind of trying to refer to some kind of unity between electrostatic and electromagnetic forces and gravitational forces. And I just wanted to straighten something out a little bit on that one, in that if you had a mass of something that has balanced electrically and you vibrate it in space, yes, there will be a force associated onto a mass nearby that it will start to vibrate as well because of the change in rate of one mass to another mass through space. And yes, those will couple to a certain amount of energy will go from one to the other, depending on the amount of vibration and the amount of mass of each one. But now, what if I were to take a dipolar element, like something in the order of, let's say, a hydrogen, which is a dipole. Let me let it drop for a second.
A single H atom or a H2 atom, you're calling it a dipole, are you sure?
No, just something with charge. Do you follow me now?
Okay. I think a single isolated hydrogen atom with a positive proton nucleus and a single electron flying around it, I think it's neutral. And a pair of them coupled together, H2, I think is neutral. Water is a dipole molecule. Hydrogen and oxygen, I think, are non-dipole. Go ahead.
You're correct. And what I wanted to do is take the dipole element and in basically in a mass and start vibrating that in space. Now what will happen is there will be a certain amount of energy that will be gravitational, but now there will be a certain amount of electromagnetic and electromagnetic, electrostatic energy also moving in space at that time. So there are two different forms of energy, as far as I know, Jack, you know, because I'm saying there hasn't been anything proven that I know of to date that shows some kind of unity between, you know, electromagnetic, electrostatic, and the gravitational forces. As far as I know, to any science that I know of available today, that joins or shows some unity between the two. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
When I transmit an electromagnetic wave, I put 100 watts into my antenna, and assume that antenna radiates in that classic dipole pattern, which is a three-dimensional pattern, is a donut, with the wire of the dipole going down the center of the donut. So I got this donut pattern of energy, that's the antenna pattern, measured in watts per square meter, coming out of my antenna at that particular range. Real energy is leaving that antenna, going out into space, and either going forever or hitting something and making an effect on it, hitting somebody's antenna, moving the electrons on that antenna, and eventually moving his S-meter on his receiver, or it hits the absorptive product and gets turned into heat. Real energy is being transmitted. If I create an E-field that creates an electrostatic field, where I've got a positive sphere and a negative sphere, and they're fixed in space, and they're creating an attractive force between the two. There's a force there, but until something moves, no work has been done. So just creating an E-field, a steady-state E-field, or creating a steady-state H-field, after it has arrived at a steady state, is not an energy-transmitting medium. Only if it is changing in some characteristic way, like an electromagnetic wave does, real electromagnetic wave, in my mind, is transmitting real energy. A steady state electrostatic field, a steady state magnetic field, I say, by itself, it is not transmitting energy. You might differ with that one, Glenn. Go ahead.
No, I'm not disagreeing at all, Dick. As a matter of fact, I just wasn't, you know, complete enough. I think you jumped in before I was able to explain the whole scenario just yet. In other words, what you'd have to do is you'd have to basically have a couple of materials so that when they were vibrating, basically what was happening was one was kind of moving against the other, creating, in other words, now you have a mass that's vibrating that's maybe you have, or let's not even talk about like just a dipole element. Let's say something more simple that everybody can visualize. Let's say a magnet and a piece of wire, and now you start rotating or moving that that magnet around that wire in space at some rate. Now you're going to transmit some electromagnetic electrostatic energy that can be measured on the other side due to that vibration. And now you have a mass moving, okay, but that also is going to transmit a certain amount of gravitational energy. But both are separate. That was really my point, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I can move real mass and I can put energy into it. A water molecule is a real dipole molecule. And whether that water molecule be water vapor or water in a liquid form, preferably in liquid form, when I put it in my microwave oven and I expose it to RF energy at any all frequency, the frequency that was left over that we just decided to use is 2.5 gigahertz. So at a 2.5 gigahertz rate, the E field and H field, but let's talk about the E field, that I'm exposing that water molecule to, and it's a dipole molecule, it tries to follow at a 2.5 gigahertz rate, flip back and forth, and follow that wave. It's got real mass, that water molecule, and it's physically really moving at the microscopic level. And that is the explanation for why the water in your food is what does all the cooking in the microwave oven, because that dipole molecule tries to follow it. That's real energy being converted into a real mechanical thing. I'll admit to you don't see the mechanics because it's microscopic, but that's a little bit more real than trying to wave a magnet around an antenna at an RF rate for a whole bunch of reasons. That's a very difficult thing to do, but I may be missing what you're saying. Back to you, Glenn, K2RIW.
My point that I'm making, I'm not making it clear enough, unfortunately, but basically what I'm saying is that the magnetic forces, okay, electromagnetic, electrostatic forces and energy transmitted through space, and the gravitational forces are really different forces, and they're measured differently. So in other words, you can actually measure the amplitude of electromagnetic and electrostatic waves in space, and you can measure the effect of gravitation moving in space, and their effects as it moves through space. But one is not directly interconnected to the other one, because they're totally different units, totally different geometries, totally different everything. They're working in two different systems of units and measure. KC2QIQ.
Not necessarily.
They appear to be very different units. The LIGO experiment, which has been going on now for a decade or two, is trying extremely hard to measure gravity waves of binary stars and supernova explosions and whatever. To my knowledge, to date, they have not been successful. So you're speculating that gravity is a wave traveled through space, which might have some cyclic nature to it, so that it is really transmitting energy. I think gravity is a force. Electrostatic attraction is a force. Those forces, under certain conditions, when motion takes place, are capable of doing work. But the presence of the force itself doesn't do work. The Earth is attracting the Moon by gravitational attraction. It holds it in that orbit. That huge gravitational force between Earth and Moon, for the most part, is not doing any work. It's a beautiful, strong force. It ain't doing any work. And to discuss and to detect the variation in gravity waves in free space, my goodness, is that difficult. To my knowledge, LIGO hasn't done it yet. Over to you, Glenn, K2RIW in the second end.
What Einstein said?
What did he say, Alex?
You know what Einstein said?
Oh, what did he say, Alex?
He said, he couldn't explain, but he said,
that the nature of gravitation is the effect of distant time. And if he would have made one more step in his deduction, he would have invented the same physics that I did.
I know you want to make a comment on all of this. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, I just don't want to be controversial and everything else. I was just saying that to every form of known science, I agree with you 100%, James, that the units of, you know, of electromagnetic and electrostatic are very well published, very well understood. The properties of gravity, very, very well understood, very well documented. You know, you can pump these into MathCAD and calculate them all day long, and now try to come up with just even a mathematical model in between the two. The first problem that you'd have is find something to unify those two forces together. And the problem, best to my knowledge, is that no one has been able to do that yet. Everybody's been trying, I know that, very, very hard to find some kind of unity principle between between the forces, strong, weak, electromagnetic, electrostatic, and gravitational. And, you know, here again, there's been nothing that I know of that's anywhere. And maybe you do have something, but you'll have to educate us all on this one and bring us up to speed. KC2QIQ.
Maybe I
can be.
Alex knows, and he's going to keep it a secret for a little while. But let me backtrack on something you just said, Glenn, that I disagree with. You think gravity is very well understood. I strongly disagree. We've got a whole bunch of experiential evidence. Mr. Cavendish and a whole bunch of other people made measurements that told us what the gravity constant appears to be by empirical measurements. What the hell creates gravity? You can give it a name. You can call it a graviton. You can call it a W particle. You can give it any name you like. I can go to my physician, he doesn't know what the hell I've got, and he calls it a virus. And he gives me some kind of a medication that hopefully will help the virus, which of course it won't. And in theory, I walk away happy, thinking I've been treated. The fact that we give it a name doesn't mean we know what the hell it is. I don't think anybody's got a clue as to what gravity is. We got a bunch of empirical measurements. Through a whole bunch of lifetime experiences, we know the way it usually behaves most of the time in the environment we've lived in. And by way of our observation of the Doppler spread of the way galaxies rotate, we suddenly realize either we don't have the vaguest idea how on a galactic scale gravity really acts, or 95% of all of the mass in that galaxy is not visible to us with any of the measurements we've made. With radio astronomy, with infrared astronomy, far infrared, near infrared, optical, near ultraviolet, far ultraviolet, X-ray, make all of the measurements you want. And you look at what you think is the gravity distribution of that galaxy that you're looking at. And we've looked at thousands of them. And they've all got this crazy characteristic. 5% of the energy is visible in all of our fancy telescopes. 95% of the mass is somewhere else. They ain't obeying all the laws we know about. Every damn one of those galaxies has a huge distribution of mass that ain't visible, so we call it dark matter. So, you think we understand gravity? I'm not sure we've got more than 1% of what the hell's going on with gravity. I'm just picking a number out of the air. Oh, you, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Well, I follow where you're going with this, but I guess my point with it is that when we look at mathematically what the units are for gravity, and you look at electromagnetic and electrostatics, and you look at all the equations that we use for that, and some of them behave in a certain manner, and you look at them all together, and you can say, okay, there's some similarities, but the units themselves are very, very different, and to find something to unify the two and bring them together, there's really, you know, there's nothing there that really ties them together. In which they are separate forces, like you said, they're a force. And as we've measured them and identified them to the best of our knowledge, there's nothing that really ties them together in any kind of unity. So when I'm saying that we understand them well, we have tools, you know, mathematics that we can use and calculate you know, by using units and, you know, scientific method. And, you know, and when you try to unify the two, there's been nothing that I know of so far that really, you know, brings them together. I'm just trying to be a little bit more careful with my words this time, because I agree with you, Dick. You know, it's obviously, do we understand everything about all of the most basic elements? Of course not. We haven't even gotten off our own planet far enough except for the moon and maybe a few satellites just sniffing around out there, taking a peek. So we're kind of, our view of the universe is really through some pretty out-of-focus glasses. KC2, QIQ.
Yeah, I go to quite a few of the open night lectures at Stony Brook University on the subject of astronomy. I was there on the supernova expose, I guess about a week or two ago, the end of November, the end of October. And the professor blithely said, gravity travels at the speed of light. I thought to myself, oh, if you can modulate something, or if I can turn it on and turn it off, like you do with an interrupter, as they did with that wheel where you send a light beam up to a mirror on the top of a mountain a couple of miles away, and you're operating this interrupter and you speed it up until all of a sudden you get eclipsing pulses, if you know what I mean. As long as you can modulate something, like a light wave, you can easily measure it, reasonably easily measure its velocity. And everybody says a gravity wave travels at the speed of light. To my knowledge, nobody has modulated a gravity wave, made it go up or down the slightest amount, made it go on and off at a given time. Without doing that, you can't measure its velocity, the speed of gravity. If that gravity measuring machine called LIGO could measure a gravity wave, and we see the coincidence between the gravity wave and some optical observation of a binary star going supernova or a gamma ray burst or something, a neutron star suddenly forming, if we saw something happening and we can relate it to a gravity measurement, you're on the path to measuring the velocity of the gravity wave. As I said, the darn many astronomers are absolutely positive it travels at the speed of light. It's a good guess. I don't think anybody knows. Alex, from your point of view, Alex, what is the velocity of...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
I have a comment to add to that one as well.
I'm going to turn it over to Alex for a second. Alex, what...
Entering the classroom and she became embarrassed and she said, I don't know. And that's my answer. I don't know, but I hope that it is much, much bigger than the velocity of light. And real space radio is going to be based on gravitational waves sometime in the future. As far as the prediction comes from my physics, which I did not relate either to you except on the AOL board, I can tell that if there is going to be a supernova around here someplace, not too far, and if you make the exact measure of any object or any mass on Earth, you are going to notice that its temperature is going to increase a little bit. That's all I have to say now.
How about that? So if a gravity wave moves much, much faster than the speed of light, then some very long interstellar communication becomes possible. I mean, if I want to talk to somebody 1,000 light years away, and it takes 2,000 years for one round trip of the message, that's a little slow by my standards. If that gravity wave would travel a few million times faster, and now I can talk to that guy, as long as I can modulate the gravity wave. And so when a supernova occurs, we get a slight cooling. But the supernova is sending out energy, which usually heats things up in the neighborhood. So there's something opposite going on there. Alex is going to have to explain that to us one of these days. Go ahead, Glenn. K2RIW in the TechNet. And then we're going to go over to John. You got it, Glenn.
Yeah, I'm going to be a little bold here, but I'm going to try to make this quick. You know, when we talk about the velocity of the speed of light, we're always referencing it to something called vacuum. So we're saying from our perspective here on Earth, with respect to a vacuum, that it has the velocity of the speed of light as defined by a vacuum. And now here again, we know with electromagnetics and electrostatics and light that if you change the medium other than a vacuum, its velocity constant is going to change. So we get a different velocity for light. So we always go back to that definition of C to say, yes, it unified it, that the speed of light is C. But its velocity is going to vary depending on the medium it's in. That's enough for me. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, that's true, Glenn, but it doesn't bother me. I mean, every one of my foam-filled cables, my dielectric cable, my polyethylene cable, my Teflon cables, they all have a velocity factor because of the permittivity of that particular material. And when it comes to measuring the speed of light in a vacuum, relatively easy to do. Mercury ducks behind the sun, and the Galileo satellites around Jupiter duck behind Jupiter. So we have real interruptions. Mother Nature is supplying them for us, by which we can make velocity measurements. And there's enough of a hard vacuum between Jupiter and Earth, and between Mercury and Earth, that I can make reasonably good measurements. So making measurements in a great big chunk of hard vacuum, Mother Nature supplies those interruptions to allow us to do that. But she doesn't do that with gravity, not to a rate that we can detect. So measuring the speed of gravity is a real hard nut to crack, as I see it. Alex may know, and maybe he's going to give us a hint one of these days, but the rest of us, I think a smart guy knows a little bit more about what he doesn't know. That's a theory. John, I know, has a second question, you're right.
Something to add though, Dick. Do we know what the velocity medium is for gravity?
I don't think so. We're not sure of the medium. Obvious by the fact that the backside of the Earth senses the gravity of the Moon, although it's indirect. Moon and Earth are really a binary system, and the two of them are running around a baryon center, a mass center, and that mass center is roughly 1,000 miles below the equator on the Moon side. So the Moon is causing a wobbling of the Earth, and so that gravity gradient creates a tide on the Moon side, and the wobble of the Earth, centrifugal force, creates a tide on the far side. Overly coincidental that those two tides are exactly the same height. So, but there's good evidence, though, that the Moon's gravity seems to propagate through the Earth and get sensed by the water on the far side. So I'm not positive about that. Does the Moon's gravity really propagate through the Earth? We're going to have to think about that one. I don't think we've got an answer to that one. John's got a second question. Before we run out of time, we better go over to him. KC2WGB, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
Well, Dick, when I start to explain this, if you think you'll need next week, we'll save for next week. But quick rundown is this. I'm looking to measure distance radio transmitters. Let's take a simple example of a repeater and someone speaking through the repeater. I'm the receiving station. I've got my oscilloscope set up. I use the original transmitter as the trigger for the oscilloscope and looking to measure the delay and knowing it's roughly nanosecond per foot, we can calculate it up. But I understand that there would be other issues involved as many different directions and things like that. Negating all of that, do you think it's possible to do something like that?
Yeah, the IFF transmitters do it all the time. Identification, friend or foe. The 1,200 megacycle transmitters that are on every aircraft, per se, every commercial aircraft, are allowing you to make a distance measurement. Because you know the propagation delay through the electronics, and it's a relatively fixed number, and there's a tight specification on it. When you send a pulse of L-band energy, 1,200 megacycle energy, toward an aircraft, and the transponder on board, called IFF, sends you a group of pulses back. How long it takes for those pulses to come back tell you range, and the signature of those pulses tell you which aircraft is responding. So making a transponder chunk of electronics that allows you to do fairly precise distance measurement is relatively easy. You would rather do it with a transponder than with a pure radar. Let me explain why. if I just transmitted a radar pulse at that aircraft, paint the skin with that radar pulse, and it reflects back. That's a beautiful way of measuring the distance to that aircraft. But there's a catch. There's a hell of a lot of other aircrafts in that environment. There's a whole lot of ground clutter. There's a whole lot of other things that are giving you an echo. There's a lot of chances for ambiguity. But in the case of the transponder, he's sending back a very specific signal on a very specific frequency with a very specific signature, a set of pulse position modulations that identifies that exact aircraft. So radio ranging by transponding is a fairly well-known science, and depending on how careful you set up the equipment, I think you can probably get whatever accuracy you desire. That's one possible approach. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Okay, Dick, what I was thinking of is I know exactly where the repeater is located. I do not know where the funny transmitter is located. But by comparing from my QTH, the delay between the initiation from the original transmission from the bunny to the opening of the repeater should give me a measurement to determine some type of distance to the bunny. Am I thinking in the right direction?
Yeah, a buddy I work with filed a patent on that exact technique. In other words, a aircraft was transmitting a signal that he was able to directly hear. The signal, in turn, was also going into another piece of ground-based electronics where the signal was being repeated, and he could hear the output of the repeater. Now, by way of him knowing where the repeater was located, knowing the time delay difference between the direct signal from the emitter and the repeated signal from the emitter, that time delay difference allowed him to draw a series of parabolic light curves as to where the emitter was most likely located. So there is a predictable shape on the ground, so to speak, of the possible locations of the emitter when you make that measurement. And if there was, as there happened to be one more repeater, now you resolve a lot of the ambiguity. But the repeated signal allows you to draw a shape on the ground. I think it was an elliptical shape or was it a parabolic shape that fits those two time delay requirements. So yes, that is a ranging and quasi-positioning technique. And I think I see where you're going, and that properly implemented could be quite helpful. Over to you, John.
Hi, Bobo. So hi, Bob.
Yes, Dick. Also, if we had three listeners instead of another repeater, and we could draw a concentric circle from our QTH, where the intersection should be pretty close, if it's possible to do this, and from what I understand you're saying, it might be doable.
Yeah, Alex is right. I think it's a hyperbola. And by having more than one listening post, and you look at the intersection of that hyperbola, you'll get a darn good location. By way of the measurements we can already make, signal strength, direction of arrival, and in my case, how easy it is to for me to overpower or not overpower the input to the repeater, and knowing the way inverse square law behaves, and making a reasonable assumption as to how many watts the emitter is using, I can make a pretty good guess as to whether or not the emitter was within 1 mile of the transmitter of the repeater site. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Okay, yeah, it was just something IVX, Lenny, and myself we were speaking about, and he'll probably talk to you further down the lock on that. But I just wanted to get your input on it to see if it was possible to measure the delay, and I wouldn't hyperbolize, or that I would just draw circles, and they should intersect because we won't be using beam antennas, we'll be using a regular vertical antenna. That's all I have right now.
Yeah, but the timing difference is the thing that you're measuring, and that turns out to be a hyperbola. There's one other variable you've got to know about, and what is the propagation delay through the repeater. The repeater itself has a IF bandwidth, an RF bandwidth, an audio bandwidth. in the repeater itself, between its input antenna connection on the receiving side and its output antenna connection on the transmitting side, there's a significant number of microseconds or milliseconds or nanoseconds of delay in the repeater itself, which is very quantifiable, rather easy measurement. And it's a fixed delay. Unfortunately, the delay through the repeater, by comparison to the free space path delay at the speed of light, the delay through the repeater is so big that it might be the equivalent of 300 miles of radio propagation delay. So, in other words, the distance measurement you're making, which is some small number of miles, like maybe you're trying to make a measurement of 15 or 20 miles, and for the portion of the signal that goes through the repeater, there's another 300 miles of apparent delay piled on top of it. It's going to affect the accuracy somewhat. Over to you, John. K2RIW.
Yes, Dick, fully understandable. And that could, it'll be a constant, and we should be able to measure that by the original transmitter's key and the time it takes for the repeater to key up. I would take that as a total delay, and we just subtract that from the calculations. I would assume we'd have to do something like that.
Yeah, you wouldn't use key up because there's a certain rise time to the keying up function, the carrier-operated relay and the PL detector and so on. Now, you're going to be putting a pulse of energy into your microphone circuit and then measuring how long it takes for the pulse to come back. And in order to get higher accuracy, you're going to make it a chain of pulses, a pseudo-random chain of pulses, and you know what signature you've transmitted, and for that great big signature you get back, you're going to slowly slide it in the time domain until it lines up and correlates. That's essentially what's being done with a global positioning satellite receiver. It knows the pseudo-random code, if you know what I mean. It's actually called a gold code. There's a 1,000-bit gold code that it matches in the time domain in order to do pseudo-ranging, so to speak. But that's all doable, and that would be a fun project. Combination of time delay, doppel scans, and whatever will eventually be better equipped. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Well, thank you, Dick. Again, you pointed me in the right direction, and I'm going to see if we can achieve something in this direction, but again, thank you for your effort. I'll kick it over to you. Maybe somebody else gets some questions here.
I am curious. How many watts of exposure would you like your specimen to receive from your magnetron of your microwave oven? Over to you, John.
Yes, and thank you again for that email. That's very interesting. And, well, I'm looking at starting because I have a fear of it right now. I want to play around with maybe 10, 20 watts and dissipate the other part of that 700-watt power. And you have a great idea with the horn and using the distance from the horn to the subject, but I'm worried about reflections, and I think they recommend you should be like 20 feet away from an 800-watt unit, if I remember what you read.
Well, if you want to receive exactly 20 watts to a particular specimen, like say, for instance, you've got a literally a guinea pig, the animal, and you want him to get 20 watts of RF energy, that might calculate to be, let me pick a number, 20 feet away from the feed horn. That's if you put him in the bore site. If you put him off into the, if the feed horn is aimed straight up into the air, and you put him off to one side in the side lobes of the antenna, and for you to measure 20 watts per meter or whatever of specific absorption rate, power flux density, off into the side lobe, you put your specimen, your guinea pig, 5 feet off to the side lobe, 5 feet off to the side, which is the side lobe of the horn, it's a quantifiable amount, you can control the exposure. So you've got a beautiful variable attenuator by way of the feed horn antenna pattern plus free space loss. You've got lots of variables in your hand there, John, K2RIW in the DECnet.
Ah, very good, Dick. Yeah, it's going to be an interesting experiment. I can't wait to procure an oven now and take it apart. But I'm going to read that article several times before. There's a lot of information in there, by the way, and it looks like I can get some good results from that. So, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, that magnetron, is a beautiful generator of bulk RF power on a slightly sloppy frequency of around 2.5 gigs, sloppy by way of a synthesized receiver. But to measure that power, to couple it into a piece of waveguide, into a horn, to aim it into some innocent direction. In your particular case, where you want a lot less than 700 watts, you want a an oven that's at the end of life, or one of the cheap small ones. That some of the cheap small ones, I think, only run 300 watts. So there's lots of ways you can cut back the power without spending a whole lot of money or using a whole lot of hardware. See, of all the discussions we've had tonight, for those few that are staying up this late, anyone else have any further questions or comments, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW and the Tech Man.
KC2QIQ.
Glenn recognized. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, I just wanted to bring up something. I'm trying to put together words here to say this in the correct fashion, but before when we were talking about permissivity, right where there's a wire and a magnetic field is generated right around it. I just want to discuss this for a minute, Dick.
Yeah, and concentrate, differentiate permissivity, permittivity, permeability, and it's probably a fourth word. We have to differentiate all those words. Permittivity versus permissivity. Over to you, Glenn.
Okay, so what I'm talking about right now is that you have an electrical current running down a wire, and there's a magnetic field with a field intensity right around the outside, and an H field. So you have B flux density, and an H field being created right at that point by the electrical current running down the wire. That's right at that individual point. Are you following me now?
Most people represent that with the right-hand rule, but go right ahead.
Yes, precisely. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to change the frequency of it and create an electromagnetic and electrostatic wave that will start to move away from that radiation point right there, from that initial E field that's being generated into a B and H field at the same time. Now, as you pointed out initially, right at that initial transmission point where the E field is maximized, the H field is maximized at the same time. Are you following me so far?
When you're in the far field away from the antenna, E field and H field hitting peak simultaneously is absolutely true. In the near field of the antenna, where it no longer obeys inverse square law, where you're so-called in the reactive near field, the magnitude relationship and the phase relationship between E and H can be anything in the world, depending on the particular physical layout. Over to you, Glenn.
That's correct, and it's dependent on the phase length down the antenna. QSL?
Without a doubt, that is one of the variables, and there are a few more. Over to you.
Right on. Now, what I'm pointing out is that if you take the total wavelength of the antenna and you view it as a full-length antenna and basically run your E field through it, the H field should be maximized when the E field is maximized at the antenna. Do you agree with that?
In the case of a dipole, when the voltage is maximum at the tips, is the current at the center simultaneously maximum? I don't think so. Now, in the reactive near field, I can represent that dipole antenna as a parallel series LC circuit. Okay, because it is series, wait a minute now. Yes, because it's series, usually the current on each component hits maximum at the same time in a series circuit. But that's only true if the series circuit is an infinitesimal wavelength in length. And now, because of length, got a time delay phenomenon. I'm not so sure that E and H of a dipole hit the peak simultaneously on the dipole itself. I'm a bit worried about that one, Glenn. It might not be true. Over to you.
Okay, I have to define this one a little bit further. Not on a dipole, but do you agree that any one point along that antenna, you're going to have an E field, and right next to that E field, there's going to be an H field perpendicular directly to that E field on that antenna, starting to create radiation right at that point.
If what you said was true, there would be no crazy reactive near-field effect. If I start off at a very far distance, and I half the distance between me and that antenna, I will get four times more energy, inverse square law. So at a far field distance, inverse square law is beautifully obeyed by every reasonable antenna. As I start approaching the near field, and then I get into the reactive near field, the inverse square law goes out like hell in a handbasket. It really goes out in a hurry. As such, the E and the H are not exactly orthogonal, not exactly co-phase. Depending on the physical layout of the antenna and the way that I'm feeding energy into the antenna. Am I feeding it as a folded dipole, as a delta match, as a gamma match? Close to that antenna, on the wire of the antenna itself, I'd be afraid to guarantee anything. What you say, the trend is true in what you say. But if you want more than 20% accuracy in the truthfulness of what you said, I'd be worried. Over to you, Glenn.
Okay, I think we'd have to look at this with finite elements to really get to the point where I'm going. But basically what's happening is that there's going to be a point along the antenna where an E field will be maximized and an H field should be maximized. This can also be viewed in a coil and a piece of a ferrite material. If you look at where the E field is maximized, the H field will be maximized. Do you agree with that?
Okay, now it depends on how you measure the E field. If I choose the peak of voltage on the tip of the dipole, the voltage of the tip of the dipole with reference to the rest of the universe, that voltage is maximum. If I look at the voltage parallel to the wire of the dipole, it's a very small number. There's a lot of H fields near the center of the dipole at the peak of current flowing through the center, and you're going to say the DVDL, the change in voltage versus length along the center, is going to be maximum. It's going to be minimum of the tip. So if I'm always measuring the E parallel to the wire, and I'm measuring the H perpendicular to the wire, I think there's a very strong trend for what you're saying to be true. So if I measure the E in that manner, I'm not just measuring the amount of E at the tip of the dipole compared to the universe. That would be measuring E at right angles to the wire, not along the wire. So in the trend, I'm going to agree with you. Over to you, Glenn.
Okay, and that's mainly because we have a piece of wire, or we can take a coil of wire and wrap it around a core at lower frequency, like as in a transformer, and we can measure when the E field is, you know, or the voltage on the, on the coil is at maximum. That's where we're going to have a maximum, you know, B field at, right at that point. Do you agree with that, like in a transformer or on an inductor?
So I think you're saying the B is maximum where the current is maximum anywhere along the wire. I'm going to agree with that.
Well, let me restate that. Voltage, right? In other words, magnetic flux, B, right? In other words, H will be maximized where the current is maximized. B is going to be maximized where the voltage is maximized. Follow me?
B is really the motive force, the ampere turn, so to speak. So the major component of B is current. So if you're saying that B is maximum where the current is maximum, and B is made up of that current, yeah, I think they go together. Go ahead, Glenn.
Right, because B over H is mu, right? So in other words, you can have B maximized, so with respect to mu, they follow each other. So in other words, that's the relationship or the squareness or the hysteresis of the BH curve. So I think you're following me now. We should be on the same page.
I might not get a hysteresis curve for a dipole, but yes, when I've got magnetic materials nearby, yes, I'm going to get a BH curve, that so-called hysteresis curve. For any reasonable magnetic materials where I'm traversing quite a percentage of the capability of the magnetic material. Go ahead.
So the point that I'm kind of making here is that at that point, I can take a voltage measurement, and I can look at and I can measure the current, and I can also take a measurement of the magnetic field, and I can measure the B, I can measure the H, and I can measure the voltage and the amps, and they should all be proportional at the same instant in time. Do you follow me?
Very close to what you're saying is that whenever antenna engineers on HF antennas wanted to know what is the magnitude of the local current, they created a very small sniffer coil. It really was a piece of semi-rigid coax cable with, let me pick a number, an eighth-inch diameter circle at the end of it where the center conductor comes out, makes an eighth-inch or a quarter-inch diameter circle, and is soldered back to the shield, and you hold that loop of wire in such a way that it's parallel to the wire of the antenna you want to measure. With proper calibration, the voltage you pick up with that sniffer loop tells you exactly what current is flowing in the wire of the antenna, even though you didn't make any contact to the wire of the antenna. You're sensing the local magnetic field, converting it into current that must have been flowing on the wire at that point. And you're sensing it with that current pickup loop sniffer. Over to you, Glenn.
Right, but I think it's also important to realize, too, that if you have magnetic material and you have a voltage in a coil, that when the voltage is maximized, the B field is maximized, and when the current is maximized, the H field is maximized. Do you follow that?
When the current is maximized, the H field is maximized. I agree with that. When the voltage is maximized, the B is maximized. When you include the real effect of inductance and the 90-degree phase lag you get through any reasonable inductance, that might not be true. Go ahead.
I think it's 100% true. This is kind of like proof that I can get to that a little further.
Radio.
But in other words, give me your explanation why you think it might not be true.
Link clear.
I know that in the case of an LC parallel network, current and voltage are 90 degrees out of phase. I know that there's some LC property built into certain antennas, particularly a slot antenna. A slot antenna, the equivalent circuit is primarily a parallel LC. So if I start measuring voltage across the gap of a slot and measuring the current that flows around the perimeter of a slot, and I start talking about them being in phase with each other, they are not. So I can show you kinds of antennas where what you are saying will be violated. Over to you, Glenn.
Here again, now, are we talking about down the length of the antenna, or are we talking about the field that's being generated next to the antenna as part of starting the first radiation pattern? See, I think that's where the difference is coming in, because for all intents and cases, if you look at calculations for voltage and B, higher voltage, higher B at that point, and where you have current, H is increased. And you, in other words, you can look at ampere turns. You look at all of the equations for H. As a matter of fact, if you look at just even what B is, and it's just by definition, it's V over amperes. So in other words, you can see what happens as amperes increasing. Actually, you can see what actually the effect of B is. Or look at the effect of B over H is equal to mu. In other words, you can put all these equations together on a piece of paper, and all of the equations will say that as the voltage increases, the magnetic field next to that will have maximized B when B is increased. I can show you these equations. I might want to email them to you to show you the point that I'm making. Because I think what's happening is that down the antenna, it's a little bit different because, in other words, you have inductive effects down the antenna, and where the V and the I are maximized, the B and the H inside the antenna is doing something a little bit different, and I think that's where the discrepancy is coming from.
Have you heard of Babnet's rule?
No, I haven't.
Okay. Babnet's rule states that if I consider my antenna as a conducting object, like a piece of wire, in space, and if I build the inverse, if I start off with a sheet of metal, and I put a slot in the sheet of metal where the wire used to be. So where I used to have a conductor, I make free space. Where I used to have free space, I make a conductor. I've made the inverse antenna. I can easily make a dipole antenna in free space. I can make a slot in the middle of an infinite sheet of copper, and when I do that, I get the identical antenna, the exact same gain, the exact same pattern. The only thing different is that it's cross-polarized. Where the dipole used to be horizontally polarized, the slot will now be vertically polarized by the IEEE definition. So there is a one-to-one duality by Babnet's rule between a slot antenna and a dipole. So far, are you with me?
Yes, I am.
Okay. The slot is usually approximately a half wavelength long, not counting capacitive loading effects. And if I put a capacitive loading effect in the middle of the slot, I can make it a hell of a lot shorter. At the instant that the voltage is maximum across the middle of the slot, that is not the time at which the current is maximum at the edges of the slot, the left-hand edge and the right-hand edge, of this horizontal-looking slot. So there's a 90-degree phase lag, approximately, between the maximum magnetic field at the corners of the slot versus the maximum E field at the center of the slot. The equivalent circuit is a parallel LC. Yes, there's an extra quarter wavelength of distance between the corner of the slot and the center of the slot. That gives an extra phase delay. But that extra phase delay goes towards zero as I start using more and more capacitive loading to bring the antenna down to a lower frequency. So there is a definite crazy phase relationship between current and voltage that are not co-phase in general in a slot antenna. KQRIW, over to you, Glenn.
That would be correct, and that's actually agreeing with what I'm saying, because in other words, right now you have a B field and H field. So in other words, when you look at instantaneous voltage, I mean, even just on an inductor, at that point, you will, as voltage is increasing and time, you will see the B field actually increasing with it at that time. Now, the H field is going to depend on current, which is going to be lagged and delayed. So, yes, you will have that principle taking place at that time. But where the voltage is maximizing, and depending on the inductance, it will, the B has to rise against the inductance. So they are following in phase in that instant. Do you follow me now?
If I choose the instant of time where at the center of the slot that's heavily capacitively loaded, I've got the maximum voltage at that instant, do you believe the corners of the slot have maximum current at that time or something other than maximum current at that time? Go ahead.
It will take time for the, you know, it's not at that instant of time, no, later.
And the amount later, I can make it any number you want. So since it is a variable and not a fixed, what are you saying?
Well, that's the length of time T. That's the wavelength of the antenna, correct?
Nope, I'm not changing the wavelength of the antenna. I'm changing its physical size. I'm keeping it on the exact same frequency of resonance. All I'm doing is changing the amount of capacitive loading in the center. I can make that slot any size you want. I can give you any phase relationship you want between voltage and current. I've got that variable in my hand. Over to you, Glenn.
Yeah, but don't you agree that by changing the capacitor, you're changing the effect of that antenna?
Negatory. It's becoming an infinitesimal dipole. I'll make no more than 4 or 5 tenths of a dB of change in gain. It'll have the exact same pattern in gain of a dipole within 3 or 4 tenths of a dB. Over to you, Glenn.
See, the funny part here is I know it's got to follow the rule, but the interesting thing is I'm not familiar with the model. So unfortunately, I can't, you know, really, you know, just mention, you know, elaborate much more on this model. It's something I'm going to have to look at. But certainly, basically, when you apply a voltage on an inductor or on the antenna or anything in this particular case, basically, B is going to start rising, okay, over some time across that L until it reaches maximum at some period of time, T. Do you follow that?
B can rise and hit a maximum. How could I disagree with that? You and I are discussing the phase relationship between current and voltage, and with the variables in my hand, I can make it anything you want on a real antenna that I work on, Glenn. So for you to make a judgment that when the voltage is maximum, the current is blank, max, min, or 45 degrees away from it, I can give you any number you want. Over to you, Glenn.
Okay, I see. Now I see where you're going. Yeah, that's true. But now you have to realize, though, that there's a field next to those voltages and currents associated going down that wire. And what you're going to have, as that current is starting to run down that wire and the voltage is building up, you know, in phase or out of phase, depending on the characteristics of that antenna, there's going to be a directly proportional electromagnetic field, you know, at right angles to that voltage and current running down that wire. Do you follow that?
A 6 meter halo hula hoop antenna has a very heavy capacitive loading at the end of it. It is extremely close to being an LC network, a parallel LC network. At the instant the voltage is maximum on the capacitor of a hula hoop 6 meter antenna, the current in that antenna is not maximum. The current in the antenna is very close to maximum only when the voltage on the capacitor is very close to minimum. They're approximately 90 degrees out of phase, Glenn. Go ahead.
Okay. Pick a segment of the antenna where you agree where the current is maximized.
The current is going to be maximized at the point that is 180 degrees away from where the loading capacitor is. So if the loading capacitor is at 6 o'clock, the maximum current point is at 12 o'clock. Go ahead.
And now, perpendicular to that part of the antenna, would you agree that the H field will be maximized at that point of the antenna at that point in time?
I'm with you. Go ahead.
Okay. Now, there's going to be another part of the antenna where the where voltage will be maximized at that period of time. Are you following me now?
Are you measuring voltage in a way that's parallel to the conductor of the antenna? Or are you measuring the voltage in some other manner? When you say voltage, are you talking about dV, dL along the length of a conductor of the antenna? Is that your definition of voltage?
Okay, I see the problem here. So let's just deal with H. Well, in other words, we have to find the unit that where we're going to start this analysis from so we can find a point where we can both agree. Okay, now at the opposite point of the antenna, we know where the current is maximized, and we know that perpendicular to that high current, that part of the antenna, there will be a maximized H field. Can we agree on that?
At the instant that the current is maximum at the 12 o'clock point on this hula hoop antenna, the dV, dL along the conductor is also maximized. The magnetic field will also be maximized at that point, at that instant. Over to you.
Very good. Okay. That's great. Now that we're analyzing that specific part of the antenna at that specific part of time, at that point, that you can see that there's a direct relationship to your H field, and you can see that the current is now maximized, and we agree on that so far. Now, what I'm pointing out is that that's a reference point because we know what it is. We can measure the electrical current, and at that point, we can also measure the H field and actually physically measure both and see that at that point in time that they are maximum.
Yes, I could decide to sense what magnitude of signal is on the antenna in a way that almost doesn't disturb the antenna by using that sniffer coil I mentioned earlier and locating the sniffer coil close to the 12 o'clock position where the plane of the sniffer coil and the plane of the hula hoop will be coplanar. Go ahead.
And at that point, we can call that a point of permissivity, right where that point is being measured, right there. Are you following me now?
Defined permissivity, differentiated from permittivity and permeability. What is permissivity? Go ahead.
Okay, let's start with permeability. We know that permeability is B divided by H, or mu. So mu is permeability. Permittivity is the point at where the energy from electrical gets directly converted into the electromagnetic right at that spot.
Give me a better definition, some more words on permittivity. Permittivity, I used to think, meant something very close to dielectric constant of a material. Go ahead.
It does, but unfortunately the mathematical equation for it isn't that simple. In other words, like when I talk about mu, I can say B over H. And unfortunately for permissivity, at that point where the energy goes from electrostatic to electromagnetic, where at that one point at that area, the calculation for that in units right now is not all that directly related, but you might have to just for right now take my word for it that at that point that is where the electromagnetic and the electrostatic are taking place. They're coupled right at that one point, H is maximized, and your current is maximized at that point.
If I had two